Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with My Science Hour, July 21st, 2022, in the ongoing year-long series of the history of the discovery of my works. And once again, this is not a discussion of the scientific discoveries themselves. It's the history. It's the information about what was going on at the time, where I was, where I was going, where I had been. My interactions with other people, other groups, etc. And I want to start out tonight by talking about what I learned about the Russian space program when I was working with the Russian scientists, because they were atmospheric scientists. They were all related, integrally related to the space program. And so the first thing I learned is that the Russians were dealing with financial issues. They, and also, in a sense, they had a lot of resources, but they did not have a lot of, say, financial resources to do, and big corporations. The whole American model of high-tech and computer-operated everything, the Russians did not have. And so you have to go back into the early 1960s, and actually before, the Russians were developing their big heavy lift rockets, which are still in use today. The Cosmodomes that are operating today in central Russia, they were where the United States was doing landings on the ocean. Russia was already developing landings on the ground, and because they had big open areas, they could come in and you didn't have to pinpoint land in a certain place, and then you didn't have to send this entire ship out to get the and pick up the capsule and the men, etc. But just to give you a few examples, when they developed, say, for example, oxygen tanks, they would have redundancy, which is very important in outer space. So they would have redundant valves, for example, to let the oxygen into the cosmonaut compartments. And they were very simple valves. And once they got a valve that worked, and was when you turned it off, it stayed off. And when you turned it stayed on and let out the amount of oxygen that you needed. But once they got that design down, they continued to use that, and they're still using it today. The heavy lift rockets, the big first stage rockets, what they did instead of developing great big rocket engines is they put many small rocket engines. And it made a lot of sense because if one of them went out, you still had a successful launch. And they built literally the most reliable rocket engines ever built by man. And so the heavy lift rockets might have 20 or 30, and that, those are just round numbers, rocket engines lifting them up. And also they were kerosene engines. And so they're still using kerosene today because it's cheap. You don't have to pressurize it. It's available. You can bring it out on a train and fill up your rocket. Another thing that they did, which is interesting, is when you see the NASA rockets going out to the launch pad, they have this big assembly building where they put it all together. Then they have these big track vehicles which move it, and the rocket is vertical as they're moving it. And it could give you a risk of this thing being blown over by the wind or falling down, because typically there's something holding on to the rocket while they're still on the launch pad, but right before they take off. But the Russians brought them out horizontally and had lift systems, hydraulic lift systems, that brought them up to vertical before the before they filled the rocket, etc., on the launch pad. And so, anyway, it was just a different way of dealing with it. Therefore, they could assemble the rocket horizontally, which made it much easier. You didn't have to lift all this stuff 300 feet up in the air. It made assembling the rocket itself much easier. So anyway, those are the few of the things, and there's kind of a comical aspect of this. NASA, in the early days of the Apollo program, sent out a contract with millions of dollars trying to develop a pen that worked in outer space. Because a pen, when you write, the tip of the pen is down. I'm talking about ballpoint pens, and gravity is literally pulling the ink down in the little teeny tube down to the ball, where it then spreads out on the paper and it writes a nice, neat line for you with a ballpoint pen. But in outer space, there's no gravity, so ballpoint pens do not work. So NASA put out a contract to have a ballpoint pen developed that would work in the gravitationless environment of outer space. And so what Russians did, however, is used a pencil. Because a pencil works every time, no matter what angle you're at, and does not need pressure, doesn't rely on pressure, anything like that. So that's just an example of how the Russians dealt with things in outer space. And another thing that I learned, but remember, by 1995, when I was working with the Russian scientists, my magnetic propulsion system was already developed, like, 15 years earlier. And so what I realized, however, in my own studies was that to go into outer space, all you needed was metallurgy, or if you were advanced enough to understand the benefits of carbon fiber and knew about carbon fiber, that would be a benefit to building spacecraft. But the other one was glass. If you could have glass, which is an insulator and allows magnetic fields to penetrate, then you can develop a propulsion system with very primitive means. And so also, if you're in outer space, you can develop materials like, say, for aluminum, you know, the aluminum foil that you use in the kitchen, you draw it out, it's a very thin sheet of aluminum foil. And you can wrap it around a pan or put a turkey in it for Thanksgiving or whatever. That same piece of aluminum made in outer space would be strong as a probably eighth-inch piece of steel. And that's because there's no impurities that make it weak. But anyway, the Russians had a way of doing things, and then just, like I say, very simply. And once they got something that worked, they did not change it. They had it was called Cosmos series. There were mini shuttles. I've talked about this before, where they put the mini shuttle on top of the rocket because they had so much excess lift capacity that they could send this extra weight up into space. And they had hundreds of flights of that while the Apollo space program was going on. Also, they told me that and I've mentioned this before, that they tried to send a man not to land on the moon, but just around the moon and orbit around the moon, swing around the moon and come back. And the cosmonauts came back very dead from severe radiation burns. And so they knew, in fact, as far as I'm aware, the Russians still, just like the United States, just like anybody else, has not had a manned mission outside of low Earth orbit since those early days of spaceflight. And NASA right now has a program, and it has for many years. It's called Living with a Star. And the whole purpose of it is to understand how to deal with and mitigate radiation, primarily from the Van Allen belts. That's the first limitation that you hit before going out into the away from Earth and into outer space, into the solar system. What I also learned, of course, is that they were very eager to learn, and they understood my work. And so as early, actually, as 1994, when Schumacher-Levy 9 happened, they were fully convinced that I was right. So they knew about my work. But it was not until after the Hale-Bopp until we actually started to corroborate and work together, and then starting this rather lengthy, many year long corroboration on exchanging information. They had the data, they had the atmospheric data, the data on storms and atmospheric electricity in Tunguska and other events that they were ball lightning in the atmosphere, tornadoes on the sun. They had all this information, but I had the theoretical work that explained it. So it was a very good mixing of talents.
And so also I want to talk about the weather work that happened. And the situation is we were looking at hurricanes, tornadoes, etc. And, of course, there's a tornado in the sun. You know, there's no clouds there. There's no weather to cause a tornado. So clearly something else was going on. And so that's where my work came in to show that it was the vertical electric field that was causing the rotary motion. As the currents went up, they rotated. It's the Coriolis force, and it's the same situation as when you pull a plug on the drain of, say, the bathtub, and the water goes down. There's that vortex action, and so it's the same thing, except it's going up. It's the tornado is pulling up. It's like a vacuum. It's a low-pressure cell, and the same with a hurricane or cyclone or waterspout. Or you'll see these above also, like an active volcano. You'll see basically a cyclonic wind pattern going up out of the volcano, and that's because it's following the electric current up. You also see it above volcanoes. This was the other observation they had. You see all this electrical activity above volcanoes, and it's not due to uprushing hot gases or some ridiculous thing like that. It's due to this plume of gas shorting out the vertical electric field. So anyway, that's where we developed the different methods for quelling the hurricanes. There were two different methods. One was with a laser satellite, where you could literally, by short-circuiting the eye of the hurricane off on one side, you could drag it off in that direction and take it away from shore or harm's way and redirect it out to sea. And so that was one of the methods. The other method was to put buoys, grounding buoys, offshore, like on especially the continental shelf of the U.S. on the eastern coast, where you would have these grounding buoys with chains on them to anchors that would then ground it to the seafloor, and then carbon fiber cords that go up to, like, basically weather balloons that are way up in the air. And this would discharge the front edge, the leading edge of the hurricane as it came in to land, and it would dissipate the charge and short-circuit the hurricane and all cause it to dump its water. So that's most of the damage of the hurricane. So you could mitigate a hurricane offshore by this method. So these were developed because they understood my theoretical work was there, and we understood that the electrical fields, vertical electric field, and the discharge of that was what was causing the hurricanes, then you could develop the mechanism for mitigating them. In fact, it was in the year 2001 that these same Russian scientists went to the United Nations, and they complained because the U.S. military had picked up on the technology. In fact, it was part of when I was with the Millennium Group that they actually sent the technology to the U.S. military to say, hey, we can develop this to mitigate tropical storms and hurricanes, etc. And then, of course, never heard back, and the U.S. military militarized it. The U.N. drew up a treaty for the prevention of weather manipulation to be used as a weather weapon in warfare, and primarily because it would be used against the populations, not against military targets. And the United States, this is under the Bush Jr. administration around 2001, refused to sign it. And, of course, after that, we had Katrina, the first major manipulated storms. You could see them manipulating storms prior to that. But Katrina was the first major manipulated storm. And then the whole thing where they blew the levees in seven places in New Orleans I'll talk more about that as that time comes, and Katrina and the ongoing manipulation of storms, etc. But it was these same Russian scientists that went to the United Nations in 2001 to prevent weather manipulation from being used as a weapon of warfare, especially against the population of the country of the United States. And like I said, the U.S. refused to sign that treaty because that's fully what they intended to do. And so it turns out that no matter what technology you develop for the benefit of man, the military is going to take it, militarize it, to use it as a weapon, an offensive weapon in many cases. Okay, so now I want to talk about recently there was announced the European Space Agency has a new program, and it is to go out and look at comets. And so this apparently has been in the planning for a number of years. And again, you have the Dirty Snowball Comet model being assumed to be the correct model, even after the Giotto spacecraft, which was French, and the Rosetta mission, which was the European Space Agency, absolutely, positively confirming that there's no snow or ice or water on a comet nucleus, just bone dry. It is made up of organic sand, like a gravel type of material, and then with rocks, etc. But absolutely no water. And the in a private conversation with the head of the European Space Agency comet probe for Rosetta, a woman, she said that the closest they were able to detect water to the comet nucleus was 10 kilometers. And so there was nothing coming off the comet nucleus. And the lead, this is at the Paris Air Show going forward, back in around 20, probably around the mid-2010 to 20 era, when the Rosetta spacecraft was circling comet 67P, the head of the French Space Agency said on live camera at the Paris Air Show, it was like a news interview, that the Dirty Snowball Comet model was simply incorrect. He just said it on air, kind of with his head hanging down. And then the news media just continues on, and the scientists just continue on with this Dirty Snowball just fantasy. But this article appeared in Space Daily June 9th, 2022, and it's dealing with this space mission to a comet, which they're going to put a space probe out, waiting for a comet to come in, then they're going to go out and visit the comet, expecting to find this pristine little snowball. And so anyway, it's once again, it's a single space program, a single space probe that's going to launch. It's not even going to launch until 2009, so 7 years from now at the soonest. Then, of course, as with any mission, it will have delays. And then there will be another half a decade minimum before it has any results. And so the whole thing is just another charade. And so you ask the question, how long can they maintain the Dirty Snowball Comet model? And it is basically forever. This is La La Land. This is Tier 2 science. And this is what they do. Their job, and they don't know it, they think they're top scientists. They're not. They're just yo-yos with a PhD in astronomy or astrophysics, whatever. And they got their job. They're getting paid. And interestingly enough, most of these people will retire before there are ever any scientific results from this project. But it's a way to just continue this charade going on and on about the so-called Dirty Snowball Comet model, and then thus preventing real progress in understanding what comets are and how they really affect the human race. And, of course, all of this done under the guise, under the umbrella of peer-reviewed science that is sanctioned and blessed and deitized, and under the watchful eye of the NASA release organizations. Okay, so anyway, very important to understand how this fits. And so one asks the question, how long can they go on with this charade? And the way the news media is set up, and, you know, basically forever. Changing gears a little bit. Now, I don't remember if, and this is getting complicated because I have so many things that I've talked about here, but I don't think I've covered this topic. It relates to basically when the Hubble Space Telescope was first being launched. Now, just to recap, it was supposed to have been launched in 1986. And, of course, it was not launched because of the Challenger shuttle, space shuttle accident, which postponed it. So finally, 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope is launched and it goes into space. But in the meantime, so I have all the paperwork for this still in my files. Of course, it's like I keep everything. But there was a public, it was kind of like a promotion, you might say, but it was a challenge, it was a competition, in which you could apply for, as an amateur, for time to use these Hubble Space Telescope. And so there were six categories of endeavor or of investigation that you could apply in. So I looked at this, and of course, and I don't remember the exact year if I went, and I don't always have access to all my paperwork where I'm at when I'm doing these shows. But it was in that late 1980s time period, so we're jumping back a little bit, but I want to include this story because it's very important. And so I decided, well, you know what, I'm going to enter all of these competitions, every different phase, and I'm going to write a proposal, and I followed, it was very specific, forms you had to fill out, and exactly what you were going to do, and what instrumentation on the Hubble Space Telescope you needed for your experiment. So you really had to know the Hubble Space Telescope very well. You had to, I mean, this was like geek level stuff, you know, where you really had to study the space telescope and understand its capabilities, what it could do and what it could not do, etc., to write your proposal. So I write a proposal into every one of these categories, and the idea was that specialists from NASA in every one of those fields would then judge the papers and then pass them up to the next level, where there was a mid-level of final scrutiny with various other groups. And then it was passed up, just the last few applications that it made through all of this screening would go up to the final group, where there was a single team of NASA specialists who would decide on exactly who would be allowed to win this competition, and there would be somebody in each one of these categories. So anyway, I enter all six. I make it through five of the very first elimination. So I have five proposals in this process. I have five proposals, and they go through the next set, and I get word that all five of my proposals make it up to the final group at NASA. And I can only imagine the look on their faces, the final judging team, because these would have been top-level NASA scientists who would have known me. It certainly in that time frame would have been very well aware of who I am and my name. So five of my proposals come into the very last phase of judging. Not a single one of my proposals was allowed or accepted. And it's just absolutely, because what I was doing was I was saying, okay, we're gonna look at comets, we're gonna look at planetary magnetosheets, we're gonna look at various other aspects, and you know, just to understand that my papers went through that first and second layer of judging. So that meant that they were all qualified in all respects in terms of the technical aspect of using the telescope, my understanding of the telescope, the benefit of doing my experiments, which I listed, of course. All five of my proposals, of the six that I submitted, five of them got to the top layer, and not a single one made it to the final round, the final table of judging. But can you imagine the look on the faces of these people as they sit down in all categories, and my name is in five of them, and they all knew who I am. I wish I could have been a fly on the wall at that point to just look at the looks on the faces of these people. But that is corruption at NASA. because, you know, that clearly one of my five should have made it, at least one, and probably all five, because, you know, when you're dealing with amateurs, they're lollipop and roses usually in terms of science. They really don't know much. And so I'm sure that the level of what I proposed was a step above anybody else in all five categories. And that's why it got there. Anyway, that's a little story that's worth talking about. Just another example of the things that I've been through during my career and the brick wall that it always hit. You want to call it a glass ceiling? I call it a brick wall. Glass ceiling is too transparent. A brick wall is a better term. Okay, so other discoveries that came along with all of this was the understanding that the solar wind is creating a differential concentration of molecules and atoms in the solar system. And so that you find that water is abundant just about every place because you have hydrogen and oxygen. But there is a differential because near the sun you have large amounts of iron actually orbiting the sun. It's in a Saturn ring type of arrangement. It's called, you can actually see it with your eyes after the sun goes down and before the sun comes up. It's twice a year when Earth crosses, Earth's orbit passes across this plane. And around the sun is this Saturnian type of ring, and it's mainly composed of iron. Because it's close to the sun. But anyway, rings form. It's one of the structures around Jupiter, around Saturn, around the sun that form because of the bulge at the center of the sun or Jupiter or Saturn caused by its rotation. The centrifugal force causes it to rotate out or expand outwards at the equator, as does the Earth's oceans, by the way. And so anyway, the solar wind creates this differential, and I like to compare it to, for example, a centrifuge. You put a blood sample in a test tube, you put it in a centrifuge, and you spin it around, and the more dense particles or cells, whatever, go to the bottom of the test tube, and then the less dense are stacked up in layers, and it separates out the various components in blood. The solar wind does a very similar thing, which allows Earth region to be what we call Goldilocks, or a region where there's water. And so one of the big questions of science is, where did the water come from? Because on the standard model of how the solar system formed, with all this stuff coalescing by gravity and crashing into the central planet coalescing by and growing, etc. As each particle hits, it brings in a lot of energy. And if there's any volatiles like water or any other chemicals, would evaporate away, they would just be vaporized and go off into outer space and never come back. So there's no way, even if you believe in dirty snowballs, by them crashing into the planet, because there's no ice on these little snowball comet model things that they think are snowballs. They're not snowballs. And they're hot, dry rocks. And so there's really no water. All of their guesses at how the water got to Earth don't work. And what I show is with the plasma discharge comet model is that the water is already there. It's part of the whole atmosphere. Now look at Venus, which is a new planet, and you have all of the components, but you have the hydrogen and the oxygen in other forms. For example, you have sulfuric acid, you have other hydrogen compounds that are volatiles in the atmosphere of Venus, which is 1,000 times denser than Earth's atmosphere. And so eventually when Venus cools down, these chemicals will start breaking down, and then you're going to have water. Eventually the water will be an end product, as the same case with hydrocarbons, oil, petroleum, what we call petroleum, were part of the original comet that formed the Earth. And then as Earth went through its life cycles, it's orbiting around the sun, every now and then a large comet would come by, and we'd go through the tail of the comet and pick up more water, and we would pick up more oil. Those are the two primary things, along with lots of other chemicals and minerals, etc., that would be in outer space. So Earth has been layered up over millions, billions of years, and we really don't know how old it is. For somebody to say the solar system is 4.5 billion years old is absolutely ludicrous. We simply don't have enough information. And to pick up a rock on the surface of Earth and somehow say that represents the age of the Earth, I mean, I mean, it's just so ludicrous. But these scientists do that because, hey, they get a paycheck. As long as they keep repeating that. The other thing is then we find that sulfur dioxide is near Jupiter. That's why Jupiter is red. That's why, and I've talked about this, for example, the red hand of death in the story of Moses was when we encountered Venus, and Venus's tail went all the way out to Jupiter and brought in this sulfur dioxide material and laid it in the atmosphere as Earth was coupling with the comet Venus at the time. And then you get out to the farther planets, like Saturn is a hydrogen deuterium. It's just it has almost the same composition as the Sun, as does Jupiter. And then you get out to Uranus and Neptune, which are big planets, and they have nitrogen-hydrogen compounds in their atmosphere, which is characteristic of the material out there, as does, say, Pluto also. But Pluto is small, and it's everything there is frozen. So you have this liquid, or, you know, it's a cross between liquid and frozen, for example, ammonia or other nitrogen-hydrogen compounds that snow into the atmosphere of Pluto as it draws in material because it's also discharging the solar capacitor. But the point is that my theoretical work deals with the structure of material in the solar system. And, of course, that's part and parcel to understanding the material and construction of a comet, because as it comes through the solar system, it's drawing in material from the local environment. Discharging the solar capacitor, that creates the negative charge, which is builds up and continues to build up as the comet progresses in cutting across the gradient of the electric field, maintains the electrical discharge, especially the primary carrier, is the stream of electrons coming from the sunward side, which maintains the nucleus negative and does it at a much higher rate than can be neutralized by the ions coming in from the non-sunward side that form the comet tail. And so this process, is drawn into the comet nucleus region, which is the region around the comet nucleus, which is charged, that's where the negative charge comes in, is the buildup of material, and especially if the comet is big enough and has a large enough gravitational field, then this material can stay on the comet nucleus and grow and grow and thus become a planet. The probability that a small comet will become a planet is really minuscule. Because it does not have enough gravitational force to hold the material there that comes in. Here's a story that occurred in around 1999. It was May of 1999, and somebody wrote me an email and said, "Hey, have you seen this Comet Lee thing?" And I'm like, "Okay." So I took a look into it, and I'm going, "Goodness, this thing is coming into a perfect alignment with Earth, but it's also multiple alignments, electrical alignments with other planets." And this would, as Comet Lee came across the Earth's alignment with these other planets, I believe it was on September 6, 1999, when the alignment was to occur. And I said, "Wow, this is so this is so unusual, because there are so many factors that are involved," and still it would be in the August return current sheet in that mid-time frame when we get the most storms, etc., because of the hurricanes, tornadoes, etc., cyclonic-type storms, because we're in this active region of the return current sheet of the solar system where the solar wind goes out and it cannot keep doing that forever. So there's a return current sheet. And so I said, "Goodness," and I made a prediction, and I think it was September 6th, 1999, if my memory serves me right. But this story is, I talk about it, I believe, in the Weather Book, and which was published, of course, later, but I recount this story. And so I made a public announcement. And, of course, at that time, the whole Hale-Bopp controversy was raging. The entire Planet X controversy was raging. And my work was center to all of this. Like I said, it was still probably in the Millennium Group page. So I make this prediction. And it's very well known that I make this prediction about a comet, and especially a little comet. Comet Lee was not a big comet, but it was going to be relatively close to Earth and up and behind us. And so up a little ways, but it still had that characteristic of being a perfect electrical alignment with Earth, the Sun, and all these other planets, and a new moon, etc., everything going on at the same time. And I don't remember all of the factors offhand, but there were many of them, including the August return current sheet. So I made a prediction. I said there's going to be severe weather. I'm talking about multiple hurricanes, etc., on September 6th. And like I said, I believe it's September 6th, 1999. September, one of those early days in September. Okay, so anyway, as the summer goes on, there's a lot of chatter on the internet. It's not possible to make these predictions months in advance. McCanny's going to be proven wrong, etc. And a lot of trolls. This was a day also, I should mention, in the day of trolls. The internet was so full of trolls. And these turned out to be programmers. And their job was to go out. This was in the early days of the National Security Agency monitoring everything, and trying to control information on the internet. And of course, being rather famous, I got just a boatload of this heat coming at me from any time my name appeared. Something, oh, McCanny says this again. Just bad. These people were gross, but that was their job. Their job was to attack, and we called them trolls. That's what they were, a troll that sits under a bridge, and internet trolls. And they were primarily programmers, and the reason they were programmers is because a lot of those people have like a minor security clearance. And so their job was to go out, and as soon as they saw something, to negate it, to bury it, to squelch it, and to name call it and make it sound crazy, etc. Okay, so anyway, as this summer goes by in July and in August, and then we're getting close to the time of September 6th, my prediction, the noise just becomes unbelievable. McCanny's wrong, you can't predict weather this far in advance, that nobody can do it, he's crazy, and on and on and on. So then the September starts. And then it really heats up, and it says there's not enough time for hurricanes to form. We were down to 1, 2, 3 days before the event that I predicted, and there's nothing. The oceans of the earth are calm as a kitten. And all of a sudden, the outrage just pours out. McCanny's wrong. There's no way he could possibly be correct. He's out of the picture. He's made his prediction, proven wrong. The night of September 6th comes, and at midnight, right before the day, the earth blows in, just the equator explodes with hurricanes. There were something like 40 major tropical storms and 3 hurricanes in the Atlantic that all formed overnight, out of nowhere. And as I said at the time, the silence was deafening. I hit it so exact on the nose on that prediction. And there was no way that these storms could be accountable by any other means, because there were just nothing. The night before, the whole world was calm. And all of a sudden, 60 tropical storms just erupt out of nowhere. And there were other things, too, that were telltale signs dealing with the fact that it was this Comet Lee that triggered it off. It was a trigger mechanism, and that's what I call it in my work. The trigger mechanisms, whether it's in the atmosphere, etc., or in the solar system, that can trigger events and cause severe weather. Okay, so my weather work is well developed, and the weather book did not come out for a number of years later, developing that. And of course, that was all part of the work too that I had with the Russian space scientists and atmospheric scientists, etc. A little commentary on a guy named Halton Arp. Now, I have letters exchanged between Halton Arp, but Halton was an astronomer, a very good astronomer, and what his life work was, you can look this up online, but basically the idea that quasars were these objects at the edge of the solar, or edge of the universe, was really strange. It entered in the world of very strange physics, because the quasars were the biggest, brightest objects in the world, in the universe, and which meant that they had the most matter, because to convert matter into that amount of energy and be that far away, because the light diminishes as the square of the distance. You know, it's a 1 over r squared factor. And so the something that is that far away and still producing that much light, being that bright, etc., would contradict the basic laws of physics of explosions. Because if this Big Bang happened, then in a normal explosion, the littlest particles should go the farthest, the fastest, and the biggest particles should stay behind and go the slowest, because it's just a matter of momentum and energy exchange, etc. But in the case of quasars, that would mean that the biggest objects went the farthest, the fastest, which doesn't make any sense. So they reinvented physics, and they said, that's where this book, The First 3 Minutes, comes from. I think, who was the author of that? It was Steven Weinberg. Was his name, and that was a famous book. It hit the popular press. It was a big seller to the public, in which the first 3 minutes of the universe, supposedly after the Big Bang, all physics was reversed. How convenient. And this is to account for the quasars that are out there at the so-called edge of the universe because of the redshift. Not only are they brightest objects in the universe, but they have the highest redshift, which, according to the Hubble interpretation, would mean that they're the farthest things away. Well, Halton Arp comes along and he says, well, wait a minute, this quasar here is attached to this galaxy, which is a normal galaxy with a normal redshift. And so they're, you know, physically attached. And you could see if you took a picture in X-rays or ultraviolet or invisible light or in infrared or microwaves or whatever frequency range you wanted to take a photo in of this object, or radio also, you would see the connection. And so the astronomy community said, oh, that's just coincidence. So Halton Arp starts building up a colossal database of all of the contradictions to this idea that quasars are at the far side of the universe. And they're simply not. They're connected to galaxies. And so here again, my work explains that, number one, the redshift is not due to it moving away from us at the speed of light or at high velocity, but it's due to the high non-uniform electric field around a fusion-based object. And because they're much brighter, that would make sense. There's a lot more fusion going on. And also, they are typically connected with other galaxies, which have very low redshifts. And so it makes sense that these are then discharging the capacitor of the central galaxy, and it causing them, just like a comet will have a much higher surface charge than the sun. It's the same situation. And so quasars then would be the initial formation of a normal galaxy in the very initial stages, and it's very excited, high levels of fusion, high levels of non-uniform electric field because of the proton wind. And that's why you have a very high redshift with quasars. So my work explains this. And so I communicate with Halton Arp, but he is under such a barrage of anger and, what would you call it, fear and loathing from the astronomical community, that I can somewhat understand he would be hard-pressed to associate with somebody like me that's already an outcast And if he associated with me, then that would give them a double barrel to go after him and call him crazy or whatever, you know. His wider field of study is an atlas that he created of unusual galaxies. So that was his main focus, but in it he found these galaxies along with quasars that did not add up. And in science, if you have contradictions to a theory, you better pay some attention, because a lot of times a single, like in mathematics, a single contradiction disproves a theorem. And so in astronomy or space science, astrophysics, if you have contradictions coming along, then you should take a look at these and do some serious analysis. Now, also, I want to talk about a amateur astronomy program that I went through. And this is moving ahead once again a little bit in time. But there were two comets that came through the solar system, and they were going to be very visible, almost naked eye visible, but easily visible with telescopes. But the interesting thing about these two comets was that they were going to be visible in the same part of the sky at the same time, and they also were a broadside view, and they were coming close to the sun, which meant they were probably going to have electrical discharge visibility to the sunward side of the comet, in other words, a sunward spike. And the standard explanation always had been for a sunward spike that it's just an optical illusion. It's really a tail pointed away from the sun, but because of the angle that you're looking at it, it just looks like it's pointed towards the sun, which is bogus as can be. But anyway, that was the rationale. And so these two comets had a broadside view, which meant that if you see a spike, a sunward spike, it's truly sunward. There's no probability that it could be anti-sunward because you're looking at the side of the comet. So I start a program, an international program, and I send out information and I send out flyers and I have my webpage and people are signing up and they're going to observe this with their amateur telescopes. Well, all of a sudden, my page gets hacked, my email gets hacked, and NASA starts its own observation program for these two comets and asking people to send all of their photos to NASA. And, of course, they can hacked into my email, so they had all the people who had communicated with me, and so ultimately, I never got a single photo from all the people that originally applied. And that's how afraid they are of what I am doing, that the public will become involved, the public will be able to easily understand what's going on. And the sunward spikes, by the time the comets were in the position to produce sunward spikes, those comets would have been visible to the naked eye. So you really, you know, a telescope obviously would help viewing it, but even if you did not have telescopic equipment, you could analyze and look at the comet and see the sunward spike. So that's how paranoid they are that people will, and that it's very bizarre too, because if you go all the way back to the Cornell years, and the main thing that Doug Fitchin, the chairman of the physics department at Cornell, when he like I say, he didn't fire me. He said, I need you to teach the class. I can't fire you. He said, but we're going to watch you like a hawk and put Betty Richardson on my, basically trailing me wherever I went on campus. And he said, you cannot talk to students about this. And that was the rule. This was the law. You cannot talk to students about this. And so that persisted, you know, that's up to this day. Okay, so just back to the comet Hale-Bopp. Remember, in the late 90s, now that's the time frame I really am concentrating on. Hale-Bopp was a comet, and when it first came in, had a companion that was orbiting it. And as time went on and as the comet coma grew bigger, that companion was inside the coma. So you could see the coma on a daily basis, whoosh, whoosh, you know, with this secondary comet inside and orbiting the first comet, the big nucleus, which was Earth size or larger. And so anyway, eventually, because of the tail drag, that companion orbited in and finally became part of the main nucleus. So that's what happened to the companion of Hale-Bopp. And to understand that whole episode from beginning to end, you have to read my book, Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X. And so that's, of course, in my library, available on my webpage. A quick comment here about something that we learned with the Russians, and they had already been working on this, that the sun is not long-term, it's not even short-term stable. The sun is convulsing on a daily basis. And it was interesting because NASA had a program where they had a satellite that went up, and its job was to monitor the sun, because one thing that would be good to know would be the solar output. And, of course, they're only looking in terms of light. What I discovered was that there's far more energy being expelled into outer space in the form of electricity, static electricity, the discharge of the solar capacitor, than there is in terms of physical light that you can see. So I'm talking about from potentially X-rays, UV light, visible light, infrared, and, say, microwaves coming off the sun. And so electrical energy of the in other words, the protons leaving the sun, the proton stream, contains much more energy than the light. And it's the electrical component of the sun that is giving us our weather. It's not the light from the sun that causes our weather. If that were the only source of heat, we would have very bland weather. We wouldn't have weather at all. It would be just a very kind of a day where there would be no wind, no clouds, there'd be no rain, there would be no hurricanes, there would be no tornadoes, cyclones, waterspouts. Did I say clouds? Nothing. You would not have any weather at all if it were just due to light coming into Earth's atmosphere. And so, very important to understand, but also that the sun is long-term unstable. And so, interestingly enough, if you look at novas around the universe that we've seen, that have been witnessed, that have been captured, there are typically stars that are very normal stars. They're not stars that are, you know, having some kind of convulsions going on for years beforehand. No, they're just normal stars like our sun, and all of a sudden they nova. They just explode. And this very well could have happened with their sun before, previously, as some of the major natural catastrophes that the Earth has seen, and mass depopulations of the Earth. But it also would be due to electrical effects. The electrical effects are dominant in terms of weather and wind, etc. So I want to cap off this session, because we're coming up to the end of the 1990s here. The biggest event of all was the comet Hale-Bopp, which was Planet X. Literally, that was. In my future studies, like I say, you can read my book, Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X. It explains in there how he went back in time and went back and checked the orbits, etc., and where Hale-Bopp was at the time. And there's no question that that's what Harrington discovered, is Planet X. It was literally under contract to NASA, the search for Planet X. So Hale-Bopp is up in the night sky. And I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day, and he said he remembered going home at night from work in the wintertime. And back in that time frame, who knows, you know, 1996, 97, 98, 99, 2000, anywhere in that time frame. And you would have looked up in the sky and there was Hale-Bopp. Big, bright, you know, and you could even see it. I remember seeing it in the daylight. That's how big and bright it was. But that was literally Planet X that had been discovered by Harrington. And, of course, throughout that entire time, the news media and the science news media managed to, well, you know, the real situation is they didn't even know about it. They were just believing everything that NASA said, that, oh, that this was a big comet with a 42-mile-across snowball. And, of course, that was just garbage. That was just make-believe fairy tale science. So Hale-Bopp, in fact, on my homepage for a very long time, I had posted, Hale-Bopp, welcome, newest member of our solar system. So it's a forming planet. It's a forming planet. And as it went out of the solar system, I saw photographs of Hale-Bopp, the nucleus, as the comet faded away and it stopped discharging the solar capacitor. And there's no question about it. It had, from what I understand, were volcanoes on the surface. And so it was an extremely hot new planet, new member of our solar system. So anyway, just once again to recap the history of Planet X, which became the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, Harrington discovers it in 1989. He goes back to New Zealand, 1990. He picks up more photographs in 1991. He goes back and picks up the final data set of photos. And that allows him to define the orbit, where that's when they discover that this thing is on a near-direct collision course with Earth. But nobody knew this at the time, that the tail drag would pull it back to the point where it would miss Earth by a period of 3 months. We were 3 months advanced in our orbit. And so anyway, it came into the solar system with a 4,250-year orbit, not a 3,600-year orbit. No, that is incorrect. And it keeps being propagated and propagated by people that don't know what they're talking about. And so the Planet X orbit originally was 4,250 years. But as the tail drag worked on the comet nucleus of Hale-Bopp, which was literally planet size, the orbit as Hale-Bopp was leaving the solar system was around 2,600 years. So it'll be back in around 2,600 years. Most of you will not have to worry about this. I don't think any of us are going to live that long. But it's important to have future generations prepared, and possibly even, it's hard to say where the Earth will be during that orbital period. So, but we have enough information now where we could find that out. It's important to warn the future generations that, say, this thing is a potential hazard for Earth, and here's what you can do about it. And here's what happened the last time and how unprepared they were, the people were. Okay, so the very last thing in the late 90s, around the year 2000, that's when I start my radio show. The same radio show, the same time slot, the same radio station, WWCR Nashville, Tennessee, Thursday evening, 6 p.m. I start my radio show, and I start it with a program that they had for selling water filters. Okay, that's fine. And so that's where my career began in the company JMCC Water Filters, which is still in existence today. Now I have my very own product line, the best water filters in the world with the best prices, that takes out the most toxins with the highest flow rate, etc., etc. So that's the primary source for you helping me, the public, bring you these commercial-free shows is with your purchases. And you get something at a very good price that you cannot find in stores. The JMCC water filters, the gravity replacement filter elements, the sink filters, and of course the MR5 whole house water filter. And remember to use the coupon code JMCC for a 10% discount. And also my webpage, jmccsci.com. So the water filter webpage is jmccwaterfilters.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.